American writers are drawn to Paris, where the City of Light plays a vivid role in their fiction and memoirs. Welcome again to Trinity Rep Radio Theater, a production of Trinity Repertory Company and WRNI. Trinity Rep Radio Theater is a monthly exploration of dramatic literature featuring members of Trinity Rep's resident acting company. Today's program, Americans in Paris, features the work of Langston Hughes, Sylvia Beach, Anita Luce, and David Sedaris. I'm your host, Bob C., and joining me is Kurt Columbus, Trinity Rep's Artistic Director.
Hello, Bob.
Hello, Kurt. And four members of Trinity's resident acting company, Janice Duclos, Stephen Thorne, Rachel Warren, and Joe Wilson, Jr. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you, Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Kurt, tell us about today's program.
Well, Bob, we've had a play running on our stages called Paris by Night, which is a sort of romance musical set in movie Paris in 1960. And so we've been thinking a lot about Paris, not necessarily real Paris, but Paris of the imagination and how Americans who live there or visit there perceive it. So we thought we'd put together a program that was about that idea. There's so much literature written by Americans about Paris. It lives very large as a place in the literary imagination. And so we've actually chosen four excerpts from memoir and fiction today. We've got Langston Hughes' memoir, The Big C, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes by Anita Luce, Shakespeare and Company, which is Sylvia Beach's memoir of her famous bookstore and it's about the expatriate literary scene in Paris between the wars. And finally, a piece that a lot of our listeners will probably have heard before. It's called The City of Light in the Dark by David Sedaris. But we're going to actually start with an excerpt from the Langston Hughes memoir, The Big C. And Bob, I hope our listeners are familiar with Hughes. He's a remarkable writer. He's a poet, novelist, one of the central figures of the Harlem Renaissance, and he wrote The Big C in 1940. We've chosen an excerpt that looks back on his arrival in Paris in 1923 at the age of 19. He had spent 2 years at Columbia University, left college, and started serving as a crewman on a naval ship traveling to Africa and ends up in Paris.
So we'll hear Joe Wilson, Jr., Janice Duclos, Stephen Thorne, Rachel Warren, and Kurt Columbus in this excerpt from Langston Hughes' memoir, The Big C, here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater.
My ticket and the French visa had taken nearly all my money. I got to Paris early one February morning with only $7 in my pockets. I didn't know anybody in Paris. I didn't know anybody in the whole of Europe. But I had made up my mind to pass the rest of the winter in Paris. I checked my bags at the parcel stand and had some coffee and rolls in the station. I found that my high school French didn't work very well and that I understood nothing anyone said to me. They talked too fast, but I could read French. I went outside the station and saw a bus marked Opera. I knew the opera was at the center of Paris, so I got in the bus and rode down there, determined to do a little sightseeing before I looked for work, or maybe starve to death. When I got to the opera, a fine, wet snow was falling. People were pouring out of the metro on their way to work. I looked across the street and saw the Café de la Paix. I walked until I came out at the Concorde. I recognized the Champs-Élysées and the great Arc de Triomphe in the distance through the snow. Boy, was I thrilled. I was torn between walking up the Champs-Élysées or down along the Seine, past the Tuileries. Finally, I took the river, hoping to see the bookstalls in Notre Dame, but I ended up in the Louvre instead, looking at Venus. It was warmer in the Louvre than in the street, and the Greek statues were calm and friendly. I said to the statues, "If you can stay in Paris as long as you've been here and still look okay, I guess I can stay a while with $7 and make a go of it." But when I came out of the Louvre, I was tired and hungry. I had no idea where I would sleep that night or where to go about finding a cheap hotel. So I began to look around for someone I could talk to. To tell the truth, I began to look for a colored person on the streets of Paris. As luck would have it, I came across an American Negro in a doorman's uniform. He told me most of the American colored people he knew lived in Montmartre, and that they were musicians working in the theaters and the nightclubs. I got to Montmartre about 4 o'clock. people were just getting up and having their breakfast at that hour, since they worked all night. I went into a little cafe where I saw some colored musicians sitting, having their coffee. I said, "I've just come to Paris, and I'm looking for a cheap place to stay and a job." They scowled at me.
"Well, what instrument do you play?"
They thought I was musical competition. I said, "None. I'm just looking for an ordinary job."
"Do you tap dance or what?"
"No, I just got off a ship, and I want any kind of job there is."
"You must be crazy, boy. There ain't no any kind of job here. There's plenty of French people for ordinary work. Unless you can play jazz or tap dance, you just as well go back home."
"He's telling you right. There's no work here."
"But go over to that little hotel across the street and see if you can't get a little room cheap."
I went in. But it was high for me. Almost $1 a day in American money. However, I had to take the room for that night. Then I ate my first dinner in Paris. Bœuf à Gracelle. Even with the damp and the slush, I began to like Paris a little, and to take it personally. The next day, I went everywhere where people spoke English looking for a job. The American Library, the Embassy, the American Express, the newspaper offices. Nothing doing. It would be better to go back home, I was advised, because there were plenty of people out of work in Paris. I said, with $5, I can't go back home. People shrugged their shoulders and went on doing whatever they were doing. I tramped the streets. Late afternoon of the second day came. I went back to Montmartre, to that same little cafe in front of my hotel, where I had no room that night. My bags were still checked at the station, so I had no clean clothes to put on. It was drizzling rain. I was cold and hungry. I slumped down at a table and ordered another café crème and a croissant, and wondered what on earth I ought to do. A tall, young, colored fellow asked me if I wanted to play dominoes. I said no, I was looking for a cheap room. He recommended his hotel, where he lived by the month, but when we figured it out, it was about the same as the place across the street. Too high for me. I said I meant a really cheap room. I didn't care about heat or hot water or carpets on the floors right now, just a place to sleep. He said he didn't know of any hotels like that as cheap as I needed. Just then, a girl with reddish blonde hair spoke up.
"You say you look at one hotel?"
"Yes."
"I know one. Not much, dear."
"Where? How much?"
"Almost not nothing. Not dear. I will show you. Come."
She put on her thin coat and got up. I followed her. She was a short girl with a round, pale, Slavic face and big dark eyes. She had on a wine-red hat with a rain-wilted feather. She was pretty, but her slippers were worn at the heels. We walked up the hill in silence. Finally, I said to her in French that I had very little money and the room would have to be very cheap or I would have nothing left to eat on because I had no work, no travail, no travail and no prospects, and I was not a musician. She answered that this was the cheapest hotel in Montmartre where she was taking me.
"Pass the two chair."
I could tell that her French was almost as bad as mine, so we switched back to English, which she spoke passably well. She said she had not been in Paris long, and that she had come from Constantinople with the ballet troupe, and that she was Russian. The drizzling rain wet our faces. The water was soggy in my shoes, and the girl looked none too warm in her thin but rather chic coat. After several turns up and down a narrow winding street, we came to the hotel. From a tiny sitting room came a large French woman. The girl spoke to her about a room, the very least, dear, for monsieur.
"Oui, a quite small room, bas a week, 50 francs.
"I'll take it, and I'll pay 2 weeks. It would leave me almost nothing, but I would have a place to sleep. I thanked the girl for bringing me to the hotel, and I invited her to a cup of coffee with me next time we met. I went to the station to get my bags, now that I had some place to put them. After paying for the room and the storage of my bags, I had just enough money left for a coffee and rolls for a week, if I ate nothing but coffee and one roll a meal. I got back to the hotel about 9. My key was not hanging on the hall board, but the landlady pointed up. So I went up. It was a long climb with the bags, and I stopped on each landing to rest. I guess I was weak with hunger, having only eaten those 2 croissants all day. When I got to my room, I could see a light beneath the door. So I thought maybe I was confused about the number. I hesitated, then knocked. The door opened, and there stood the Russian girl. Hello.
I first returned me.
Her coat was hanging on a nail behind the door, and a small bag sat beneath the window. She was barefooted, her wet shoes were beneath the heatless radiator, and her stockings drying on the foot of the bed. I said, Are you going to stay here too?
Of course. Mais oui. Why you think I find one room?
She had her hat off. Her red blonde hair was soft and wavy. I laughed along with her, since I didn't know what to say.
I have no money, neither.
We sat down on the bed. In broken English, she told me her story. Her name was Sonia, and she was 24, older than I was. She had danced in Bucharest and Budapest, Athens and Constantinople, Trieste and Nice, where her ballet troupe went to pieces because the manager fell ill and contracts and work permits ran out. So she, who, like me, had never seen Paris before, had packed up and come north. Now, her costumes were all in pawn, and her best clothes, too. But from the hands of the usurer, she had managed to hold back one evening gown of pearl-colored sequins hanging limp against our wall. And here we were, in a room that was all bed, just space barely to open the door, and a few nails in the barren wall on which to hang clothes. No table, no chair, but a deep window seat that could serve as a chair and a place to put things on. No heat in the radiator. It was cold. So cold you could see your breath. But the rent was cheap, so you couldn't ask for much. We didn't ask for anything.
If you have some francs, I go chez l'épicerie and get white cheese and 1 small bread and 1 small wine, and we have supper. Eat right here. That way, are less dear.
I gave her 10 francs, and she went out shopping for the supper. We spread the food on the bed, and it tasted very good and cost little. Cheese and crisp French bread and a bottle of wine. But I could see my francs gone in a few days more. Then what would we do? Sonia said she was looking for a job, and perhaps she could find one soon. Then we both could eat. But not being accustomed to the friendship of the dispossessed, I wondered if she meant it. Later, I knew she did. But bread and cheese once a day couldn't keep hunger away. Selling your clothes when you didn't have many couldn't keep hunger away. Going to bed early and sleeping late couldn't keep hunger away. Looking for a job and always being turned down couldn't keep hunger away. Not sleeping alone couldn't keep hunger away. Sonia did her stretching exercises on the bed every morning. There wasn't room to do them on the floor, and she wanted to keep in shape in case she got a job dancing. But Montmartre was full of Russian dancers and no jobs. Sonia found work as a danseuse at Zelly's famous nightclub in the Rue Fontaine, not as a dancer in the show, but as a dancer with the patrons, a girl who sits at tables, dances with the guests, and persuades them to order 1 more drink and then another, usually champagne. She got no pay, but drew a commission on every bottle she could persuade a guest to buy. Result? She drank a great many glasses of champagne every night, because the faster she could help a bottle to disappear, the sooner a new one would be opened by the attentive waiters with the commission added in Sonia's column. The danseuse would dump her glass into the ice bucket if she got the chance, and the waiters would carry bottles away, half-emptied, if the guest was not observant. Then she would sigh.
Oh, it is so very warm this night. Couldn't we have just another one little drink champagne, please?
And if the guest was at all a good sport, he would naturally give the waiter the nod to open another 200-franc quart of Cordon Rouge that had appeared like magic in the ice bucket on his table. After some weeks, I still hadn't found a job yet, and most of my clothes were sold. But one morning, at daybreak, Sonia woke me up with a joyous shout.
Look here!
She opened her pocketbook, and it was full of money that fell out all over the bed. Where did you get it?
Took it from a Danish who wasted anyhow.
It seems that a visiting Dane in Paris for the first time had got very drunk on the 8 bottles of champagne Sonia helped him order. So when closing time came, Sonia kindly helped him pay his bill, too. And in doing so, simply helped herself to a large handful of the Dane's francs.
I didn't take him all. Just some little I need.
She was very happy to have money, and so was I. We both dressed and went to the barber shop and got our hair cut. I got a shine, and Sonia a manicure. We had had luncheon at a cafe on the Place Pigalle. After that, we went to a movie on the boulevards, my first theater in Paris. At dusk, we came back to the little cafe on the Rue Broyère. We were sitting just inside a big window overlooking the street when all of a sudden Sonia went down under the table. Startled, I thought she had fainted. But no.
Shh! The Danish! They're outside?
Apparently, that visiting Dane was just passing the window outside. Fortunately, he didn't look in. While Sonia sat on the floor under the table, he continued ambling along, down the hill, in the dusk, out of sight.
Ooh.
Ooh. By now, I'd been in Paris a month and still had no job. I tried all the big nightclubs, so I decided to try the little ones. I noticed a little club in the Rue Fontaine that had no doorman. The owner turned out to be a colored woman from Martinique. I addressed her politely in my best French and asked if she needed a chauffeur. She looked at me a moment and finally said,
Oui, 5 francs et le dîner.
5 francs and dinner? Naturally, I accepted. Then and there, she showed me the way to the kitchen where the cook fed me. And at 10 o'clock that night, I took up my post outside the door. The heavy dinner the cook made me and the big bottle of wine that went with it made me very sleepy. So sleepy, but I went to sleep standing outside the door. I couldn't help it. I slept almost all night. I had no uniform, but the next day at the flea market, I bought a blue cap with a gold braid on it, which gave me the air of authority. My salary? 5 francs a night was less than a quarter in American money, but it was a great help in Paris until I could do better. Shortly after, I started working for the Martinique lady. Sonia secured a contract to dance at Le Havre. So one rainy night in March, I went to the Gare Saint-Lazare with her to say goodbye. She cried, and I felt bad seeing her cry. She had been a swell friend, and I liked her. She waved at me through the window as the long train pulled out. I waved back. I never saw her anymore. That night, I felt lonesome and sad, standing outside the door of the little club in the winter cold. My collar turned up, my cap with the gold braid pulled down as far over my ears as it would come. A few weeks later, a friend told me that they needed a second cook at the Grand Duke. I couldn't cook, but I decided to say I could. Fortunately, second cook really meant dishwasher, so I got the job. They fired another boy to give it to me. Strangely enough, he had been from Cleveland, too. A tall, brown-skinned fellow named Bob. The bosses said he came to work late and was unreliable, broke too many dishes, and cussed out the proprietors. The colored manager told me to be at work at 11. Salary? 15 francs. And breakfast. I was coming up in the world.
This is Trinity Rep Radio Theater. We've just heard an excerpt from Langston Hughes' memoir, The Big C, featuring Joe Wilson Jr., Janice Duclos, Stephen Thorne, Rachel Warren, and Kurt Columbus. Well, we definitely hear about the romantic lure of Paris, and Langston Hughes is obviously impressed with all the icons of Paris, but he also faces the real economic desperation.
Yeah, it's really beautiful to see Paris through his eyes, I think. And that's one of the things that, again, in looking at all of this old literature and all of the movies that we started watching, you start to realize that Paris doesn't exist as one place, but as sort of a bunch of different places. Everyone has their own Paris, if you will. And that's, you know, we talked a lot before the show today about all of our experiences visiting Paris and the many people that we ran into. And that there's not really one place that you visit, Bob, but it depends on you, really.
Mm-hmm. You know what strikes me, too, in reading this and also coming off of course, well, Paris by Night, is in places where you barely speak the language and it's such a foreign place, the amplification of emotion, how in these moments everything becomes heightened for you in terms of your senses, what you're seeing, what you're feeling, and even heightened anger, heightened joy.
Yeah.
That, of course, struck me, too, when I think about my first trip to Paris, you know, the fights I had and the joys I had. Everything seemed to taste better and smell better, and the light was just perfect. And so that heightened emotion is something else that also strikes me in thinking about being in a foreign place.
Well, and Hughes is clearly, it's not only heightened by being in a foreign place, but he's 19.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's that youthful moment, which you can never get back again, where you end up sharing a room with a Russian dancer. You know, you're suddenly living with someone, and that's something that can only happen when you're 19, right?
Mm. Right. 19 and broke.
Yeah. Yeah, we love the phrase, the quick friendship of the dispossessed.
Right.
Yeah.
That really sums up what happens with them.
Gorgeous.
What about the special appeal of Paris for African Americans? Here's 19-year-old Langston Hughes, and it's 1923. What's it like for him there?
Well, we did a lot of research. Paris by Night had race as one of its elements, and we did a lot of research about the fact that Paris, particularly before 1965, was a very racially diverse and accepting place. You know, the story that I always tell people is that Lena Horne, the great American singer, could not marry her white then boyfriend in America, in California, but they both moved to Paris and married and lived there for about 8 years because Paris was a place where they could just be who they were. So it, I think the part of the allure for somebody like Hughes was that he could be more who he was there.
Well, next we have a rather a different take on the city.
Yes. Yes. We're going to go to the darling Anita Loos and a really lovely little excerpt from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. You know, Bob, most people are familiar with the movie with Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell, but Anita Loos is a much more trenchant writer, if you will. She's much more like a Dorothy Parker as a writer than she is like O. Henry. I mean, there's a sharp edge to it. She was a successful screenwriter and a literary celebrity in New York, certainly friendly with the Algonquin Round Table, and an intellectual woman. But she wanted to write about Lorelei Lee, this woman who shows up in Paris in 1925, and it started. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes debuted in serial form in Harper's Bazaar. We're going to hear just an excerpt from Lorelei's diary, and we join the story as she and Dorothy have left Little Rock and New York, and they arrive in Paris.
We hear now an excerpt from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes featuring Rachel Warren here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater.
April 27th. Paris is divine. I mean, Dorothy and I got to Paris yesterday, and it really is divine. Because the French are divine. Because when we were coming off the boat and we were coming through the customs, it was quite hot, and it seemed to smell quite a lot.
So I looked around, and I picked out a French gentleman who was really in a very gorgeous uniform, and he seemed to be a very, very important gentleman. I gave him 20 francs worth of French money, and he was very, very gallant, and he knocked everybody else down and took our bags right through the custom. So we came to the Ritz Hotel, and the Ritz Hotel is divine. Because when a girl can sit in a delightful bar and have delicious champagne cocktails and look at all the important French people in Paris, I think it is divine. I mean, when a girl can sit there and look at the Dolly sisters and Pearl White and Mrs. Corey and Mrs. Nash, it is beyond worlds. Because when a girl looks at Mrs. Nash and realizes what Mrs. Nash has got out a gentleman, it really makes a girl hold her breath. And when a girl walks around and reads all of the signs with all of the famous historical names, oh, it really makes you hold your breath. Because when Dorothy and I went on a walk, well, we only walked a few blocks, but in only a few blocks, we read all of the famous historical names, like Cody and Cartier. I mean, I knew we were seeing something educational at last, and our whole trip was not a failure. I mean, I really tried to make Dorothy get educated and have reverence. So when we stood at the corner of a place called the Place Vendôme, if you turn your back on a monument they have in the middle and look up, you can see none other than Cody's sign. So I said to Dorothy, does it not really give you a thrill to realize that this is the historical spot where Mr. Cody makes all the perfume? So then Dorothy said that she supposed Mr. Cody came to Paris and he smelled Paris and he realized that something had to be done. So Dorothy will really never have any reverence. So then we saw a jewelry store, and we saw some jewelry in the window, and it really seemed to be a very, very great bargain. But the price marks all had francs on them. So we went in and asked, and it seems it was only $20, and it seems it is not diamonds. It is a thing called paste, which is the name of a word which means imitations. So Dorothy said, paste is the name of a word a girl ought to do to a gentleman that handed her one. It really makes a girl feel depressed to think a girl could not tell that it was nothing but an imitation. I mean, a gentleman could deceive a girl because he could give her a present and it would only be worth $20. The gentleman in the jewelry store said that quite a lot of famous girls in Paris had imitations of all their jewelry, and they put the jewelry in the safe and they really wore the imitation so they could wear it and have a good time. But I told him I thought that any girl who was a lady would not even think of having such a good time that she did not remember to hang on to her jewelry. So then we went back to the Ritz and unpacked our trunks with the aid of a really delightful waiter who brought us up some delicious luncheon and who is called Leon and who speaks English almost like an American. So Leon said that we ought not to stay around the Ritz all of the time, but we really ought to see Paris. So Dorothy said she would go down to the lobby and meet some gentlemen to show us Paris. So in a couple of minutes, she called up on the telephone from the lobby, and she said, I have got a French bird down here who is a French title nobleman who is called a Viscount, so come on down. So I said, how did a Frenchman get into the Ritz? So Dorothy said, he came in to get out of the rain, and he has not noticed that it has stopped. So I said, I suppose you have picked up something without taxi fare, as usual. Why did you not get an American gentleman who always have money? So Dorothy said she thought a French gentleman had ought to know Paris better. So I said, he does not even know it is not raining. But I went down. So the Viscount was really delightful after all. So then we rode around and we saw Paris and we saw how divine it really is. I mean, the Eiffel Tower is divine. And it is much more educational than the London Tower because you cannot even see the London Tower if you happen to be two blocks away. But when a girl looks at the Eiffel Tower, she really knows she is looking at something. So then we went to a place called the Madrid de Tea, and it really was divine. I mean, we saw the Dolly sisters and Pearl White and Mrs. Corey and Mrs. Nash all over again. So then we went to dinner, and then we went to Montmartre, and it really was divine because we saw them all over again. I mean, in Montmartre, they have genuine American jazz bands and quite a lot of New York people, which we knew. You really would think you were in New York, and it was divine. So we came back to the Ritz quite late. Dorothy and I had quite a little quarrel, because Dorothy said that when we were looking at Paris, I asked the French Viscount what was the name of the unknown soldier who is buried under quite a large monument. So I said I really did not mean to ask him if I did, because what I did mean to ask him was what was the name of his mother. Because it is always the mother of a dead soldier that I always seem to think about more than the dead soldier that has died. So the French Viscount is going to call up again in the morning, but I'm not going to see him again, because French gentlemen are really quite deceiving. I mean, they take you to quite cute places, and they make you feel quite good about yourself, and you really seem to have a delightful time, but when you get home and come to think it all over, all you've got is a fan that only cost 20 francs and a doll that they gave you away for nothing in a restaurant. I mean, a girl has got to look out in Paris, or she would have such a good time in Paris that she would not get anywheres. So, I really think that American gentlemen are the best after all, because kissing your hand may make you feel very, very good, but a diamond and sapphire bracelet lasts forever.
An excerpt from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes by Anita Loos, featuring Rachel Warren here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater. I kept getting these Carrie Bradshaw vibes from this early 20th century version here.
Where's my Cosmo?
I guess history is in the eyes of the beholder.
Yeah. The historic places like Coty Perfume and Cardi. It's Cardi, just Cardi. So incredible to listen. And Rachel found her inner Lorelei Lee, who's not as dumb as they say she is. Now, is she?
Oh, God, no. She knows exactly what she wants and how to go about getting it. And she's very shrewd about it, you know, and actually clever in the rest of the book. She's quite clever about her way of getting around the requirements of her patron, or you know, order to have all the fun she wants with exactly who she wants and get where she wants to end up. I mean, it's sad and it's sadness, but you know, and she presents this simple sort of face, but she's really quite shrewd.
And the book is really fascinating. I mean, it's really beautifully written. I mean, Janice, you and Emily worked on Emily Atkinson, our other producer, worked on the adaptation, and found, I think, that it really stands up. I mean, Luce's writing really has something in it.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, I thought it was very interesting that Bob made the connection with Sex and the City and Carrie Bradshaw. I mean, this is a material girl.
Uh-huh.
You know, and this was written quite a while ago, and, you know, it still stands up. I mean, she's a woman who goes, and you're looking at Paris through her eyes.
Right.
And it's very interesting that she seeks out things American there and comes to the conclusion that American gentlemen, anyway, really are superior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just love the judgments that she makes about the jewelry, the imitation jewelry, and the way gentlemen could deceive you if they were actually to give you something like that, you know. Yeah. And she, you know,
and that makes her very sad.
Yeah, makes her very sad. These poor Parisian women, they just don't know.
There's something, Bob, that the listeners won't know, which is that Lorelei calls it the Eiffel Tower. It's EYEFULL. You really get an eyeful when you look at the Eiffel Tower, and that's how it's written in the book. There are tons of little brilliant touches like that are really incredible.
Yeah, I think it's so much fun that, you know, for her, this is idea of Paris representing everything she's trying to get away from too, the glamour and the you know, the glamorous people. And this character came from nothing. Mm-hmm. And for her, she thinks that Paris is representing this, you know, the epitome of class and where she belongs. But then she gets there and she finds there are things like these imitation diamonds.
And the way people smell.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. And thank God for Cody.
Yeah. He got to Paris and he smelled
it. Inventing the perfume. Yeah. Oh, something had to be done. Yeah.
Lord. It's fascinating, too, to compare this story then with the one that we're going to read next, because this is the lighter side of Paris, but we're actually going to jump ahead a couple of decades, if you don't mind, and hear something from Sylvia Beach. Much more serious vein. Sylvia Beach was a central figure in the American literary expatriate community in Paris and in the years between the wars. She opened a shop, Bob, called Shakespeare and Company, which was an English language bookstore, and everybody mm-hmm. visited there. Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Stein, they all came to Shakespeare and Company, and she, in fact, encouraged Hemingway so much that he made her a character in his Immovable Feast. She also published James Joyce's Ulysses in 1922 when absolutely no other publishing house would. So she's a remarkable writer and a remarkable personality, and she was living in Paris, in her adopted city, when it fell to the Germans in 1939, when she was 52 years old. And this is an excerpt from her memoir at that particular moment.
We'll hear Janice Duclos in an excerpt from Sylvia Beach's memoir, Shakespeare and Company, here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater.
At the end of the summer of 1939, posters summoned all the young men to join their regiments, and there was great mourning in all of the families. Shakespeare and Company remained open. The war went on. Then, suddenly, the Germans swept over France. As they came nearer and nearer to Paris, the population fled or tried to flee. Day and night, people streamed through the Rue de l'Odéon. People camped and slept in front of the railway stations in the hope of getting on a train. Some left in their cars, which had to be abandoned along the roadsides for lack of gas. Most of them fled on foot, carrying babies and baggage, or pushing baby carriages or wheelbarrows. Some had bicycles. Meanwhile, a constant stream of refugees from the north and northeast, including Belgium, people uprooted from their farms and towns, flowed through the city toward the west. Adrienne and I did not join the exodus. Why flee? My Canadian student assistant, Ruth Camp, did try to get away. She was machine-gunned in the ditches and was later interned in spite of her efforts. A lovely June day in 1940. Sunny, with blue skies. Only about 25,000 people were left in Paris. Adrienne and I went over to the Boulevard Sébastopol and through our tears watched the refugees moving through the city. They came in at the East Gate, crossed Paris by way of the Boulevard Saint-Michel and the Luxembourg Gardens, then went out through the Orléans and Italie gates. Cattle-drawn carts piled with household goods. On top of them, children, old people and sick people, pregnant women and women with babies, poultry in coops, and dogs and cats. Sometimes they stopped at the Luxembourg Gardens to let the cows graze there. Close on their heels came the Germans, an endless procession of motorized forces, tanks and armored cars, and helmeted men seated with arms folded. The men and the machines were all a cold gray, and they moved to a steady, deafening roar. There were a few Nazi sympathizers in Paris called collabos, but they were the exception. Everyone we knew was for resistance. Parisians who survived the exodus came back, and my French friends were delighted to find Shakespeare and Company still open. They fairly stuffed themselves on our books, and I was busier than ever. I had a volunteer helper, a young Jewish friend, Françoise Bernheim, a student of Sanskrit, but now excluded from the Sorbonne by the Nazi laws. She was encouraged by her professor to copy the notes taken by her non-Jewish friends, and with his help and theirs, she was persevering in her studies. I had resisted all the efforts of my embassy to persuade me to return to the United States. Instead, I had settled down to share life in Nazi-occupied Paris with my friends. Also, as I went about with Françoise, I shared with her some of the special restrictions on Jews, though not the large yellow Star of David that she wore on her coat or dress. We could not enter public places such as theaters, movies, cafes, concert halls, or sit down on park benches or even on those in the streets. Once we tried taking our lunch to a shady square. Sitting on the ground beside a bench, we hurriedly ate, looking around furtively as we did so. It was not an experience that we cared to repeat. When the United States came into the war, my nationality, added to my Jewish affiliations, finished Shakespeare and company in Nazi eyes. We Americans had to declare ourselves at the commandant and register once a week at the commissary in the section of Paris where we lived. Jews had to sign every day. There were so few Americans that our names were in a sort of scrapbook that was always getting mislaid. I used to find it for the commissaire. Opposite my name and antecedents was the notation, "Has no horse." I could never find out why. My German customers were always rare, but of course after I was classified as the enemy, they stopped coming altogether, until a last outstanding visit ended the series. A high-ranking German officer, who had got out of a huge gray military car, stopped to look at a copy of Finnegan's Wake that was in the window. Then he came in and, speaking perfect English, said he would buy it. "It's not for sale." "Why not?" "My last copy," I explained. "I was keeping it." "For whom?" "For myself." He was angry. He was so interested in Joyce's work, he said. Still, I was firm. Out he strode, and I removed Finnegan's Wake from the window and put it safely away. A fortnight later, the same officer strode into the bookshop. Where was Finnegan's Wake? I had put it away. Fairly trembling with rage, he said, "We're coming to confiscate all your goods today." "All right." He drove off. I consulted my concierge. She opened an unoccupied apartment on the third floor. My own apartment was on the second floor. My friends and I carried all the books and all the photographs upstairs, mostly in clothes baskets, and all the furniture. We even removed the electric light fixtures. I had a carpenter take down the shelves. Within 2 hours, not a single thing was to be seen in the shop, and a house painter had painted out the name Shakespeare and Company on the front of 12 Rue de l'Odéon. The date was 1941. Did the Germans come to confiscate Shakespeare and Company's goods? If so, they never found the shop. Eventually, they did come to fetch the proprietor.
An excerpt from Sylvia Beach's memoir, Shakespeare and Company, here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater with Janice Duclos. A very moving account of a very dark time in the city of Paris's history, certainly. Some of your thoughts about what she has told us here in this story.
Well, we wanted to include something that acknowledged that Paris is not just the city of light and the city of lovers and the city of rivers. There's a place in Paris where you can look at the Eiffel Tower, a really beautiful view, and behind you is the building where the League of Nations met and, of course, then failed. You can't escape the history of Paris. And Beach really reminds us that there have been lots of dark times there as well.
Just picturing Paris after an exodus with there being only 25,000 people in the entire city, it's just kind of hard to imagine. And when I think of an exodus, when I think of refugees, I always think of a poorer place than Paris. To imagine this flood of the dispossessed marching through Paris, the gay Paris of our imagination, of the movies, of you know, the tourist destination, to think of it during that time.
And it sounds so quiet, too. I mean, in all of the descriptions of this, it just sounds like a very quiet place, which is just odd.
Yeah, Stephen, that's exactly, I mean, that's one of the things that is so special, though, about Paris is that everywhere that you go, there's a music to it. And when I think of Paris, I think of that music. I don't think of silence, but Beach's descriptions are of quiet places and deserted, desolate parks.
Yeah. And the extent to which she goes to deny Germans any possession of the city's life and spirit is really
And
really
the fact
remarkable.
That she chooses to stay.
Yeah.
She is going to stay here with her Parisian friends and experience this. Yeah.
And was sent to a concentration camp for 6 months and, you know, when released had to be in hiding for the rest of the war. I mean, it's not like it was easy for her to stay, but she did. She did.
Well, our last piece is by someone who a lot of NPR fans might be familiar with. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yes. Well, we wanted to end on a lighter note. Our last piece is from David Sedaris's Me Talk Pretty One Day, which was published in 2000. And Sedaris is writing about he's moved to Paris. And the rest of the book is all about his learning French. But we actually chose a slightly different perspective, and it really doesn't need any introduction.
So let's hear The City of Light in the Dark by David Sedaris, read by Stephen Thorne.
When asked to account for the time I've spent in Paris, I reach for my carton of ticket stubs and groan beneath its weight. I've been here for more than a year, and while I haven't seen the Louvre or the Pantheon, I have seen the Alamo and the bridge on the River Kwai. I haven't made it to Versailles, but did manage to catch Oklahoma, Brazil, and Nashville. Aside from an occasional trip to the flea market, my knowledge of Paris is limited to what I learned in Gigi. When visitors come from the United States, I draw up little itineraries. If we go to the 3 o'clock Operation Petticoat, that should give us enough time to make it across town for the 6 o'clock screening of It Is Necessary to Save the Soldier Ryan. Unless, of course, you'd rather see the 4 o'clock Ruggles of Red Gap and the 7 o'clock Roman Holiday. Me, I'm pretty flexible, so why don't you decide? My guests' decisions prove that I am a poor judge of my own character. Ayatollahs are flexible. I am not. Given the choice between four perfectly acceptable movies, they invariably opt for a walk through the Picasso Museum or a tour of the cathedral saying, I didn't come all the way to Paris so I can sit in the dark. They make it sound so bad. Yes, I say, but this is the French dark. It's darker than the dark we have back home. In the end, I give them a map and a spare set of keys. They see Notre Dame. I see the Hunchback of Notre Dame. I'm often told that it's wasteful to live in Paris and spend all of my time watching American movies, that it's like going to Cairo to eat cheeseburgers. You could do that back home, people say. But they're wrong. I couldn't live like this in the United States. With very few exceptions, video killed the American revival house. If you want to see a Boris Karloff movie, you have to rent it and watch it on a television set. In Paris, it costs as much to rent a movie as it does to go to the theater. French people enjoy going out and watching their movies on a big screen. On any given week, one has at least 250 pictures to choose from, at least a third of them in English. There are all the recent American releases, along with any old movie that you'd ever want to see. On Easter, having learned that The Greatest Story Ever Told was sold out, I just crossed the street and saw Superfly, the second greatest story ever told. Unless they're for children, all movies are shown in their original English with French subtitles. Someone might say, get your fat ass out of here before I do something I regret, and the screen will read, leave. I sometimes wonder why I even bothered with French class. I am truly delighted to make your acquaintance. I heartily thank you for this succulent meal. I have yet to use either of these pleasantries. Since moving to Paris, my most often used phrase is, one place, please. That's what one says at the box office when ordering a ticket, and I say it quite well. In New York, I'd go to the movies 3 or 4 times a week. Here, I've upped it to 6 or 7, mainly because I'm too lazy to do anything else. Fortunately, going to the movies seems to suddenly qualify as an intellectual accomplishment, on a par with reading a book or devoting time to serious thought. It's not that the movies have gotten any more strenuous, it's just that a lot of people are as lazy as I am, and together we've agreed to lower the bar. Circumstances foster my laziness. Within a 5-block radius of my apartment, there are 4 first-run multiplexes and a dozen 30- to 50-seat revival houses with rotating programs devoted to obscure and well-known actors, directors, and genres. These are the mom-and-pop theaters, willing to proceed with the 2 o'clock showing of The Honeymoon Killers, even if I'm the only one in the house. It's as if someone has outfitted his den with a big screen and comfortable chairs. The woman at the box office sells you a ticket, rips it in half, and hands you the stub. Inside the theater, you're warmly greeted by a hostess who examines your stub and tears it just enough to make her presence felt. Somewhere along the line, someone decided that this activity is worthy of a tip, so you give the woman some change, though I've never known why. It's a mystery, like those big heads on Easter Island, or the popularity of the teeny-weeny knapsack. I'm so grateful such theaters still exist that I'd gladly tip the projectionist as well. Like the restaurants with only 3 tables, I wonder how some of these places manage to stay open. In America, the theaters make most of their money at the concession stand, but here, at least in the smaller places, you'll find nothing but an ice cream machine tucked away between the bathroom and the fire exit. The larger theaters offer a bit more, but it's still mainly candy and ice cream sold by a vendor with a tray around his neck. American theaters have begun issuing enormous cardboard trays, and it's only a matter of time before the marquees read, "Try our barbecued ribs," or "Complimentary baked potato with every 32-ounce sirloin." When they started selling nachos, I knew that chicken wings couldn't be far behind. Today's hot dogs are only clearing the way for tomorrow's hamburgers, and from there it's only a short leap to the distribution of cutlery. I've never considered myself an across-the-board apologist for the French, but there's a lot to be said for an entire population that never, under any circumstances, talks during the picture. I've sat through Saturday night slasher movies with audiences of teenagers, and even then, nobody has said a word. I can't remember the last time I've enjoyed silence in an American theater. It's easy to believe that our audiences spend the day saying nothing, actually saving their voices for the moment the picture begins. At an average New York screening, I once tapped the shoulder of the man in front of me, interrupting his spot review, to ask if he planned on talking through the entire movie. "Well, yeah, what about it?" He said this with no trace of shame or apology. It was as if I'd asked if he'd planned to circulate his blood or draw air into his lungs. "Gee, why wouldn't I?" I moved away from the critic and found myself sitting beside a clairvoyant who loudly predicted the fates of the various characters seen moving their lips up on the screen. Next came an elderly couple, constantly convinced they were missing something. A stranger would knock on the door and they'd ask, "Who's he?" I wanted to assure them that all their questions would be answered in due time, but I don't believe in talking during movies, so I moved again, hoping I might be lucky enough to find a seat between 2 people who had either fallen asleep or died. At a theater in Chicago, I once sat beside a man who watched the movie while listening to a Cubs game on his transistor radio. When the usher was called, the sports fan announced that this was a free country and that he wanted to listen to the goddamn game. "Is there a law against doing both things at once?" he asked. "Is there a law? Show me the law, and I'll turn off my radio." Sitting in Paris and watching my American movies, I think of the man with the transistor radio and feel the exact opposite of homesick. The camera glides over the cities of my past, capturing their energetic skylines just before they're destroyed by the terrorist bomb or advancing alien warship. New York, Chicago, San Francisco. It's like seeing pictures of people I know I could still sleep with if I wanted to. When the high-speed chases and mandatory shootouts become too repetitive, I head over to the revival houses and watch gentler movies, in which the couples sleep in separate beds and everyone wears a hat. As my ticket is ripped, I'll briefly consider all the constructive things I could be doing. I think of the parks and the restaurants, of the pleasantries I'll never use on the friends I am failing to make. I think of the great city teeming on the other side of that curtain, and then the lights go down. And I love Paris.
We've been listening to The City of Light in the Dark by David Sedaris, read by Stephen Thorne, here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater. You know what the greatest thing about this is? That it's really true. And, you know, there's David Sedaris in Paris with all the high culture all around him. What does he do? He goes to see the American movies, which are shown all over Paris, and it's really very accurate. And he uses it to reflect on American culture, which I think is really...
Yeah, and Stephen, you said you've done this.
Yes, yes. When I was in Paris, I did go to a movie, I think, with this thing of like, well, how will it be different than my experience? And the thing is that in some ways it's not different. In some ways it is different. You know, it's just the experience is kind of different. And I think he points out in the piece, you know, that there is something of a little bit of a different feeling about going to movies over there.
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
He sort of steps on both sides of the fence in this, that he's sort of like, I'm a little bit of a hermit doing my American things, but he's doing it in the French way, at least according to him.
You know, this really sums up this piece, part of how I feel about Paris, the Paris of my imagination, and that is that it's very civilized, and that they do things there better than we do. And that, for example, they know how to watch a movie.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Or cut bread.
Yes. Or drink a cup of coffee at a cafe. They know how to do those things.
Right.
Everyone does.
Yeah.
Everyone.
And there is some truth to that in the real Paris, too. Every once in a while, you're like... This coffee, and maybe that's what, Joey, what you were saying earlier, that it's just the heightened experience of being in that city. You feel like everything tastes better. This is the best coffee I've ever had. Look at this piece of bread. It's so bread-like, you know, and you just feel like you're so intensified by being there.
Well, you've been listening to Trinity Rep Radio Theater, and we've been talking about Americans in Paris. You can hear this program again and find archived programs from our first two seasons at WRNI.org. This program featured excerpts from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes by Anita Loos, copyright 1925 by permission of Live Right Publishing, The Big C by Langston Hughes, copyright 1940 by permission of Harold Olber Associates, Shakespeare and Company by Sylvia Beach, copyright 1959 by permission of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Publishing and Frederick Beach Dennis, and The City of Light in the Dark from Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris, copyright 2000, published by Little Brown and Company, with permission of David Sedaris. Trinity Rep Radio Theater is a production of WRNI and Trinity Repertory Company. Janice Duclos and Emily Atkinson, producers. Kurt Columbus, executive producer. Joe O'Connor, general manager. And Jim Moses, sound engineer. Trinity Rep Radio Theater is made possible in part by generous support from the Rhode Island Foundation, a charitable community trust serving the people of Rhode Island. Thank you for joining us, and please tune in again next month. I'm Bob C.